the U.S. State Department announced a new commission this week that's going to take a closer look at the meaning of unalienable rights. The term probably sounds familiar because you can find it in many of our founding documents, like the Declaration of Independence. But Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says the meaning of unalienable rights has gotten confused over time. Here he is talking to reporters about the commission on Monday.
We must, therefore, be vigilant that human rights discourse not be corrupted or hijacked or used for dubious or malignant purposes. It's a sad commentary on our times that more than 70 years after the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, gross violations continue throughout the world, sometimes even in the name of human rights.
Bernadette Myler is a constitutional law professor at Stanford Law and joins us now. Bernadette, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So what is the line you think that Secretary of State Pompeo is trying to draw between natural or God-given rights and ad hoc rights?
It's a very interesting commission that he's set up. He wants to reaffirm unalienable rights from the Declaration of Independence. And we might recall that the Declaration protects certain unalienable rights, among these life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and states that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men. And what he wants to do is have a return to the founding era and the founding documents of the United States, as opposed to the understanding of human rights through the international community. Now, there are a number of kinds of international human rights that have risen mostly during the 20th century, and the history on the rise of human rights is contested. Someone like Sam Moyne argues that it only came up in the 1970s, that human rights really only became something to be reckoned with in the 1970s. Other people date it to the 1940s. Most people don't really think of the Declaration as articulating human rights rather than natural rights of persons. Now, the distinction that Secretary Pompeo seems to want to draw is between certain kinds of unalienable rights, like the ones protected in the Declaration, and more recently recognized rights, like social and economic rights. For example, the right to work, or the right to a home, or rights to same-sex marriage. The other kinds of rights that might also be at issue here are rights of religion. I think that there may be ways in which the founding era or returning to the founding era would suggest a more thoroughgoing emphasis on religious liberty rights than some of the more recent human rights documents. Another issue may also be about the articulation of state sovereignty as opposed to human rights. So he seems to be drawing a line between unalienable rights and rights that government can opt to protect. So what some of the members of the commission that he set up have defended governments like those of Saudi Arabia or of Turkey against claims that they are violating human rights. And this commission may, in fact, support certain governments that other nations might think are violating human rights.
Well, and that leads to the question of how the announcement of the formation of this commission has been received both at home and abroad. What kind of responses have you seen?
I've seen fairly critical responses to the commission. I think that there's a concern that a lot of the members of the commission are people who have a strong history of supporting religious liberty, but not other forms of human rights recognized by the international law community in the 20th century. Marianne Glendon, who is the director of the committee, the chair of the committee, is a very respected scholar from Harvard, but is thought of as someone who has affirmed religious liberty rights, but has been somewhat skeptical of other kinds of welfare-oriented rights or socially-oriented human rights.
And often there are words that may have started with a very specific meaning, say a legal meaning, and are used in everyday conversation, and we do use them in maybe not exactly the precise ways that they started out with. So what is legally, what is a right?
A right, there are actually several ways of thinking about rights, and part of that, the diversity of meanings of rights actually is part of the argument. So a right can either be a natural right that's retained against any government, or it can be a right that is given up in service of a particular social organization. So one of the arguments about human rights is that those are rights that are retained against any government. Someone like the philosopher Thomas Hobbes would have said there's only one right that people don't give up when they enter into society, and that's the right of self-preservation. So a right is some kind of claim to freedom or to a gift from government or some kind of endowment from government. And in general, the U.S. Constitution has been thought to protect negative rights or negative liberties, meaning they protect against government interference. But other kinds of constitutions, especially those that protect social or economic rights, tend to be supporting various functions of society. So there's a right to education. That's a right that government has to provide rather than something that a person is free from within government.
We're talking with Bernadette Myler right now. She's a constitutional law professor at Stanford Law School. And we're talking about a new panel that the U.S. State Department has put together to reexamine the definition of unalienable rights. And Bernadette, has this been attempted before? Have there been other efforts since, you know, the use of those words a couple centuries ago to redefine or update or take back to original meaning?
Definitely. There have been many attempts to redefine unalienable rights. In fact, one could argue that the redefinition project has been present from the very beginning. One notable aspect of the Declaration is that it was often taken, even from very shortly after the founding moment and ratification of the Constitution, as an unfulfilled promise. So especially abolitionists, those who were trying to abolish slavery before the Civil War, latched onto the Declaration and the Declaration of Unalienable Rights in the Declaration as something that the Constitution had failed to realize, that the Constitution, because it was a pro-slavery document, because it had various compromises in it that allowed for slavery, hadn't lived up to the idea that everyone, every person, has certain unalienable rights. And so the Declaration was used very extensively before the Civil War on behalf of the freedom of those who had been enslaved. So that was kind of the first instance of the effort to use the Declaration in ways that would maybe go against some of the other founding documents. And then also, it's not exactly the Declaration, but in the Constitution, there have been updatings of rights. So the main way in which the Constitution has been interpreted to protect rights, or what people would think of as human rights in the international community, is through the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, which gives every person the equal protection of the laws and also allows every person due process. And so the due process clause of the 14th Amendment is where we get, for example, the right to make a decision on abortion or the right to be free from excessive medical intervention or other forms of rights. And there have been a lot of contests about what those rights actually include. There was an argument that they should include a right to education. That hasn't been as successful as claims for other kinds of rights.
Is it sometimes a debate between perspectives where looking at whether something is actually a right or if it's a privilege? Because I'm thinking of things like there are some who will say healthcare is a human right, and others will say healthcare is a privilege if you pay for it, if you work for it, if it's provided to you and you take advantage of it. So is that kind of the dichotomy between a privilege and a right?
Definitely. And I think you're exactly right about where this commission is going. What Secretary Pompeo suggested in his statement announcing it was that there was a concerning blurring of the distinction between unalienable rights and ad hoc rights granted by governments. I think those ad hoc rights granted by governments that he was referring to are exactly what you would be calling a privilege. So a lot of the argument about human rights right now is to what extent social rights and economic rights are privileges as opposed to unalienable rights. And traditionally, the United States hasn't respected those kinds of rights as part of its constitutional scheme. So in a way, this commission is trying to defend the American conception of rights as against the international human rights conception of rights.
There's concern in some quarters that this panel might be used to try to deprioritize protections for LGBTQ individuals abroad. Can you connect the dots for us? How would that happen?
Definitely. So one interesting point of background here is that a lot of the Supreme Court decisions that led up to the decision that same-sex marriage is constitutionally protected were reliant in large part on Justice Kennedy, who recently retired and was replaced by Justice Kavanaugh. Justice Kennedy was very influenced by international human rights documents, so he was one of the only more conservative members of the court who really looked to international law for guidance. And he looked to it in the death penalty context. He looked to it in the context of same-sex rights. So one of the things that happened fairly recently on the Supreme Court was the constitutionalization of same-sex marriage through the 14th Amendment of the Constitution again. Now, that was partly relying on these international human rights protections for anyone getting married, for anyone being able to enter into same-sex relationships. Now, I think that one of the concerns here, because the commission is so reliant on people coming from religious backgrounds who have been sometimes critics of same-sex marriage, including Marianne Glendon herself, there's a concern that that will mean that the commission comes out with a declaration that LGBTQ rights are not protected in the same way as the unalienable rights that the commission is going to protect.
We're picking up our conversation with Bernadette Myler, a constitutional law professor at Stanford Law School. She's with us today to talk about what the term unalienable rights means and how that meaning has changed over time. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you remember learning about unalienable rights in school? Do you think the meaning does need to be clarified? What questions do you have for our guest about what the term means and how that actually impacts you and your protections under the Constitution or how the United States moves abroad? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. And Bernadette, what kind of power does a commission like this have? Does it have a direct impact on policy, or is it likely to support a position that Secretary of State Pompeo and others might be hoping to move on anyway?
I don't think it will have a direct impact on our policy. I think that what this will allow is for the United States to have a justification for resisting certain kinds of rights in the international human rights sphere, or to be more concrete, right? So if a regime is criticized for violating human rights, if the commission comes out with a report that says that those rights are not unalienable rights, then the Secretary of State can point to the report and say, well, we don't agree with the definition of human rights that these international human rights documents are providing, and instead we're supporting this vision of human rights.
And this is obviously looking at foreign policy, diplomacy, relations with other countries, because it is coming out of the State Department, but is there a possibility that this commission's work and the conclusions that it comes to could be applied in a domestic sense as well?
I think it's unlikely that it will be applied in a domestic context. The background here is that the United States has been fairly resistant to entering into any human rights agreements on the international level. And that's a fairly long-standing resistance, especially under the Bush administration. There was an articulation of a policy to prioritize U.S. sovereignty over international human rights. And in particular, the U.S. refused to enter into the agreement for the International Criminal Court that 123 countries now participate in. So the U.S. has often dissented from international human rights agreements. Now, I think what's new here is basically that Secretary Pompeo is trying to get the commission to come up with a justification for that, and a justification based on U.S. constitutional norms.
And the idea of human rights and promoting human rights abroad, I mean, often the U.S. politicians like to talk about, you know, spreading U.S. values, and often that means, you know, human rights at a higher level. Has it become politicized more recently, or has it always been a politicized issue?
I would say that it's always been a politicized issue. Interestingly, I think the U.S. has promoted U.S. conceptions of freedoms abroad for a long time. There's an interesting set of studies about how the CIA used the First Amendment protections of freedom of speech and freedom of artistic expression during the Cold War to suggest that the United States was better than communist countries. And so the CIA funded Jackson Pollock and other avant-garde artists to show that the U.S. would support even these kind of outrageous methods of artistic expression, or what were considered at the time outrageous methods. So that's one example of a U.S. use politically of human rights. I think that it's possible also that it's being human rights are being used politically by the international community. Certainly, there are different human rights committees that have different views about what's politically desirable. And I think that there is a valid critique from the U.S. standpoint of some international human rights commissions as not sufficiently democratic, that they're rooted in a kind of administrative logic that isn't really democratically legitimate. That's one of the concerns about the International Criminal Court, that it's not supported by some international legislature or other international body that would be able to be more democratically accountable.
And we are, as we can tell from our own conversation here, this is a fairly philosophical topic. How do you think that this commission is going to approach their work? What are they going to be looking at specifically?
I think it's a really good question. One thing I think they will be looking to is going back to the roots of something like the Declaration and unalienable rights in the Declaration. A lot of the members of the commission have a strong background in religion. There are a couple of members who are Catholic, and actually natural rights developed initially out of a Catholic tradition. And so I think they may be going back to those first principles. I think they'll also be looking to a lot of the international documents that are currently in place and the international agreements, and looking at which of those agreements they think really reflect unalienable rights or not. I just want to give maybe two examples of cases that might turn out differently based on the decision of the commission or what the commission comes up with. So one example is felon disenfranchisement. So the U.S. allows for people convicted of felonies not to be able to vote for the rest of their life. It depends on the state, but there are still states that permit this. Now, that's not considered to be in conformity with human rights. The UN Human Rights Committee had a report about 10 years ago claiming that U.S. policies violated international human rights law. I would think that the commission would say that that was not a legitimate unalienable right, so that would be one case that would where the U.S. would resist the norms of the international human rights community. Going the other way is a case involving a family that came from Germany because they weren't allowed to engage in religious homeschooling in Germany, and this happened in about 10 years ago also. And the Romika family wasn't allowed to engage in homeschooling in Germany, and they made an asylum petition on that basis. It wasn't granted by the courts, but ultimately they were allowed to stay by President Obama. But I think that claim of religious liberty might be looked at more favorably under the commission's report, if I'm accurate about how they would come out on this.
And Bernadette, do we have a sense of when we might start seeing anything coming out of this commission? Is there any kind of a timeline in place?
I haven't seen any reports of a timeline, so I'm not sure. I would think it would take at least several months to a year for them to come out with anything.
And we had a question from a listener, Fitzgerald in Prairie du Chien, who said he has heard inalienable rights, spelled I-N, and we've been saying unalienable rights. Are they the same thing?
Yes, they are the same thing. It's spelled unalienable in the Declaration, but basically fungible. Inalienable and unalienable are the same thing.
All right. So a philosophical and grammatical conversation together. Bernadette, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Bernadette Myler, a constitutional law professor at Stanford Law School. She was with us today to talk about a new U.S. State Department effort to look into what the term unalienable rights means.